You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast and listeners, a brand new episode. Now, today's show is all about how to get top marks in between the whiteboards, because we have got one of the most well-respected, established judges on the circuit. He has ridden at the very, very top levels at the Olympics, at the Badmintons, the Burleys, all the big five stars himself. And he is none other than Peter Gray. Peter, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It is so good to have you with us. We're looking forward to picking your brains because you've got a really, really big year ahead, because I think you are on the ground jury. You're doing the four-star short at Kentucky, but the big one being that you're on the ground jury for those World Championships for Eventing in Pretoni this year.
Yes, Nicole. Believe me, it's quite an honor. We spent a lot of time to get licensed and trained for this level of competition. And I really respect the FEI for choosing me. It's quite an honor and I'm extremely excited and I can't wait to do a very, very good job for the competitors.
Oh, well, we're looking forward to seeing how it all goes and seeing how the team competition plays out as well. First of all, we're hoping that you are going to be able to pass on some pearls of wisdom. So whatever level anybody is competing at, whether it be the very, very top level of the sport, whether it be a local training show with a young horse, whatever it may be, we want to be able to hopefully give some top tips as to how to get maximum marks and to be able to come away full of confidence, ready for next time. So first of all, I guess, what do you look for as a judge, as a ground jury member, as a dressage trainer? What are the key foundations for you?
Well, the key foundations would be a relaxed horse, showing the freedom of gaits, the quality of the gaits, and to ride in a forward, fluid way, but to show suppleness. And I think really people don't have a clear understanding of what suppleness means. It actually is very simple. It means the ability to flex and bend. So where the directives say to show bend, for example, if you enter on the center line and it says C track left, and in the directives it says show bend, then the judge is going to give you bonus marks or modifiers in a positive way if you show bend. And it is quite remarkable how many people don't show bend or in fact show counter bend, which is a clear indication that you're showing the judge your horse is not supple that way. So I would say people have this misconception at the lower levels that they have to go deep in the corner. And quite honestly, that's what all of our trainers tell you to do. All I can tell you as a judge, you're going to get better marks if you don't go deep in the corner and show suppleness, or what I refer to as a bit of a banana bend through the horse's body. The expectation is to be able to go deeper into the corner with a more balanced horse when the requirements involve collection, which isn't until the three-star level at Canter. So yeah, show suppleness, show bend, make smooth, rounded turns, and don't go deep into the corner.
That's so interesting. How much of it, to a degree, is, you know, when you have your test sheet, paying attention to all of those tiny little bits that might be sort of giving you a clue as such as to what the judges are looking for? Because there's a lot of information on there.
There is a lot of information. And I'd encourage riders to, as we refer to the directives, understand that it's not to teach the judges how to judge, but it's to give the riders and competitors an indication of what the judge is looking for. So the directives are for the competitors, not the judges. So pay attention to those and try to have a better understanding of what you're trying to execute with each movement and what you're trying to prove or show to the judge.
And what about training at home? So perhaps you've got, you know, your next competition on the horizon. What should you be focusing on at home, and how much test riding would you encourage at home?
Well, that's a great question, because as I reviewed all of the US 2022 tests, it occurred to me that no longer can you learn the test in the lorry on the way to the competition. you now have to actually practice the movements at home, because some of them are quite complicated. And if you have never practiced them, it will be very clear to the judge. For example, in the beginner novice test at A, you're in working trot, at A, you have to walk over A 4 to 6 steps and then back to trot. Well, this actually takes quite a bit of precise riding, and a horse that really is responsive to the aids coming back from the half halt and going forward from the leg. And to get the timing with a beginner novice horse, 4 to 6 steps is not an easy feat. And if you haven't practiced it, I can promise you at 10 steps and 11 steps, you're going to be kicking and you finally your horse will go into trot. So you really have to practice these tests at home. I really like the direction in which these tests have gone. I think the authors have done a very, very good job. And what they're testing for me is that you're on the correct pathway of training with what you're doing at home. Yeah, practice the test, understand the movements. Hopefully your trainer can help you to get the most marks for these particular movements you can do. You did mention test riding, practicing the test. When I was competing, I thought I knew what the judges were looking for, but clearly I didn't. I never did that well in that phase. And it's interesting now that I'm competing FEI in pure dressage. But I think the key is that I never asked them. I just assumed I knew. So more and more around the country, around the world, we're seeing test riding. So the riders have a better understanding of what they have to do when performing in front of the judge. So test riding, if you have a local judge that can spend a few hours with a group of you, it's a fabulous exercise.
And I guess the other thing as well is if you've got a local event, go and volunteer to be a scribe, because you would learn so much. It's like free training for an entire day.
Oh, Nicole, that is so true. Every scribe that I have thanks me profusely at the end of the day for all the things that they learned. They had no idea that we were looking for the things we were looking for and how to get extra marks by doing things differently. So scribing, not only is it helping the competition organizers to have an extra volunteer, but I agree with you, it's such a valuable thing to do for your own knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And even picking up all of those different things that judges look for and different judges and what is important and the common mistakes people make and where they throw away marks, but also where they get marks as well is really, really key. Would you be a fan of doing a lot of, so when you're training at home, almost riding as if you are in a sort of test environment, that sort of must keep going, must treat this as a real thing sort of thing? Because it's very easy in training, isn't it? You know, if you do a 20 meter circle and your horse breaks into canter, for example, you might be tempted to go around, do it again and correct it, which is fine. But obviously you can't do that in real life in a test.
Yes, I think that two things. In that particular instance with breaking to the trot, I would go back and repeat it, but understanding that the trot is very unbalanced. And I see so many people give the horses a kick and make them go right back into canter. Well, of course, then the canter is balanced. It's a reflection of the balance of the trot before the transition. So take your time to reorganize the trot, balance it, and set yourself up for success to have a really nice canter.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so our training at home is going well. We are ready for our competition, or our next competition is upon us. We have learned the test extremely well. We could recite it backwards almost, listeners. We couldn't recite it backwards. That'd be way too complicated. You know what I mean? We know it well. And then we are heading off to our competition. So first of all, warming up. How important is it to almost create a plan for your warm-up with your trainer or with somebody that you trust, or even just have in your own mind going into a competition?
So just briefly going back to the previous question, as a trainer, my personal belief is to do short intervals of good quality work. I'm not one of these people that go round and round and round until the quality of the work starts to diminish as the horse gets fatigued. But short intervals of good quality work, good quality exercises, so that the horse understands you give him a break. He can absorb that information, clear his mind, feel good about the way that the training is going that day, and stay in a positive outlook, along with the rider being in a positive outlook. At the competition, I think first of all is to understand the temperament of your horse and to understand what kind of warm-up works best for him. A horse that is a bit cold, maybe won't need much, perhaps would need just a little bit of a hack around the show grounds and a quiet hack around the warm-up area. I find it's very beneficial then to put them away, whether it's in the trailer or in the stable, and then back out again. And that cold-blooded horse would need perhaps only 20 minutes of final warm-up. With a hotter horse, I found, for example, every horse is a bit different, but I would do the same hack around the show grounds, put them away, come out and have some work for 30 minutes, put them away. And with some horses, I found it works best at that point to maybe get your jacket on and just get on and trot down the center line without any final warm-up. But this is what I'm saying. You have to find out what works best with your horse and find out through schooling shows and local small shows, practice this warm-up procedure and see what works best. You have to be a little bit brave to do that, hopping on at the stable and then just cantering down the center line. But honestly, with the hot horses, it works very well.
I was going to say they really, that is brave, isn't it? You know, because you have to kind of figure out what works for them. And sometimes it's not going to work and you're going to have to chalk it up to experience and go, okay, well, you know, I know that doesn't work. I'll move on to try the next thing. But actually it's okay for that to happen.
Yes, it is. So find out what works best for your horse. Some of the more advanced horses who can get a little bit hot after 8 minutes, well, guess what? 8 minutes, you're in and out. So you've kept them quiet for the whole duration. You really have to use your horsemanship skills and find out what your horse requires. But it doesn't matter if you have a cold horse or a hot horse. That final or the middle phase of our training that we're doing for 30 minutes, for me, there's three main goals in our warm-up. Number one, relax your horse. Number two, get him supple. In other words, the ability to bend to the left and the right. And we can do this with small circles and walk with exaggerated bend, turn on the forehands, leg yielding with bend in the opposite direction. Lots of things we can do. And number three, get him listening to the aids, forward from the leg, coming back from the half halt. So when you think about it, relax your horse, number one. Number two, get him supple. Number three, in front of the aids. Now, what that does for me is it makes that warm-up very clear what our objectives are. There's no cloudy area. You shouldn't be going round and round and round in circles with following everybody else. You should have a clear plan. And I think those three things help with that clarity.
I'm a big planner. I love a plan. I think it's amazing how much of a difference it makes to your sort of direction if you go in with a plan. And especially if you get nervous, because the last thing you want to be worrying about when you're nervous is making a plan. Whereas if you have some very simple objectives to work towards, it feels very achievable. What about sort of that last couple of moments before you go into the arena? So the horse before you has finished their test. Do you notice as a judge when you've got a new combination around your arena? Should riders be smiling merrily at you, or are you very much thinking about the previous combination and not there yet?
Well, depending on the scheduling, I like to finish one test and have 60 seconds to pause and take a deep breath and get my mind clear and ready to give that next rider a 10 for the entrance. So I like, as a personality, not to be rushed. And going back to your previous question, time management, you like to have a schedule. I encourage all riders to have a very clear, detailed, written out by the minute. At 8:05, we're doing this. At 8:35, we're doing that. At 9:06, we're doing this. This will really help a nervous rider or one that's perhaps new to the sport. But yes, when they are going around the ring, I do like to have a little time just to see what I'm about to judge. Although, of course, we shouldn't prejudge, and we shouldn't form any strong opinions about what we're looking at. But I think the use of that time for a nervous rider is very, very important. And they should ask their trainers the question, what should I do going around the ring?
What should they do? What would you like to see riders do going around the outside of the arena? Or what would you recommend your students to do at that point?
Very simple. Show the judge what you can do, not what you can't do. So pick something that's a highlight in his training that he's going to do well. But having said that, if all of a sudden, and we see this so often, the loudspeaker or something, the flags, the crowd get the horse a little bit nervous, have plan B, rising trot, stretch him in a low frame. You have to be clever about doing whatever it takes to get the horse in the best frame of mind before you enter the ring.
So rising trot, so particularly when you go up the levels, you know, and your test perhaps requires you to sit to the trot. Just explain what rising trot does for the horse on the outside of the arena.
Well, let me start by saying 12 years ago when I bought my first FEI dressage horse, I bought a schoolmaster from Carl Hester, and I was so excited to take this big gray for his first show in Canada. And at the end of the test, the judge said to me, and she knew me as an event rider, she said, "Your top hat is too tall, your bridle is brown, and your saddle's black, and never rise the trot going around the ring." And I thought that was the stupidest thing I've ever heard a judge say. And I was so happy. I was in Hong Kong for the Olympics, and I saw Anki von Grunsven doing rising trot going around the ring because her horse got a little bit tight. And I believe that rising trot, even in a little bit of a forward position with the pole a little bit lower, will encourage the horse just to let go of his back and relax his body. So again, you have to be outside of the box, which most dressage riders are very enclosed in a very tiny box without much flexibility, and use good horsemanship.
Good horsemanship. That is a phrase that I like a lot. Okay, so we've impressed you massively. We've given you a beaming great big smile. We've shown off our horses counter canter on the outside of the arena. We've taken a deep breath. We're ready to start our test. So what for you makes a great first impression, that fast movement? How do you nail that first impression?
I think to come in with presence, to come in and look polished and look at the judge and tell him through your eye contact that he's about to see the best test so far of the day, as opposed to coming in, looking down, feeling a bit pathetic. Riding in front of a judge is like performing on stage. You have to show your brilliance. You have to show your confidence. And I think something I haven't discussed with colleagues, but I think a lot of marks, and we're not talking big marks, but we're talking 0.5 marks, are given subconsciously. If the horse is being ridden in a very soft and light way, I was trained to the softness of the contact and to the respect that the horse's mouth was paramount. So if I see someone riding in a way that I like, then of course subconsciously I'm going to tick all the boxes from our training as judges to make sure technically everything is going correctly. But it gives me a good feeling. It gives me a positive feeling to get good marks with that very, very first turn, C-track left or C-track right, that you ride it more like a half circle with bend. I see so many riders in that very first movement going right up to the judge. The horse's eyes almost pop out of its head when he sees all the paperwork that the scribe has flapping in the breeze. So keep his nose away from the judge. Keep him looking inwards. Round off that turn. It's the very first time the judge has seen you from the side, and show, you know, the quality of those gates.
I love that.
At a higher level of competition, I remember when I was on Global Exchange, I did an event in France and Poland. And when I was in the UK, I found that the top riders over there, it was very interesting. It was almost like an intimidation stare down as they came down the center line. And even as they tracked to the left, some of the riders were still looking at me. And what they were demanding was my attention. They were demanding my attention to not miss a single thing because this was going to be a brilliant performance. Very interesting.
I am always fascinated by watching the top riders. You know, when you go to like Kentucky, to badminton, the Olympics, even in pure dressage, seeing what the riders do on the outside of the arena and sort of their their presence with the judge. And the one that never fails to make me smile is Michael Young, who, double Olympic champion, you know, absolutely brilliant in all three phases, capable of some brilliant dressage scores. And he has a real look at me, makes eye contact with every single judge around that arena, smiles very broadly, and basically gives them, translates a message that is like, right, watch this, because I'm just about to deliver. Yeah. And you just can't help but smile, because exactly. He does it. I really notice it now, and listeners, I'm sure next time you see it, he's coming over to Kentucky, watch him on the outside of the arena in Kentucky, because it works. Like, you just sit up, you pay attention. And that's just as a viewer watching at home. Okay, what are your bugbears? What do people lose marks on in a test that you think, don't do that, because you don't need to lose those marks?
Well, to repeat, literally slowing down the tempo to go deep in the corner. I think they haven't understood that the number one score that we as judges pull out of the sky for the trot shoulder in is basically the quality of that horse's trot. And then if they're showing suppleness through bend and flexion and the tempo is even throughout and they have a good energy and engagement, then what was a 7 for the basic gait for the trot could go up 8. But if in that shoulder in, they're not showing any suppleness at all, no bend, no flexion. In fact, it's on 4 tracks and more like a leg yield. We're going to go down from that 7 to a 5. So understanding what it is that the judge is looking for, the quality of the gait. So if you are trotting around the ring and your horse cannot go deep into the corner, you're going to get better marks if you round off the corner and keep this lovely big flowing trot instead of slowing down and affecting the balance, probably getting hiccup in the tempo and losing the roundness. So understanding how the judge is marking every movement, I think is very, very important. But the quality of the gait, so, you know, ride in a way that you're going to best do that. And it makes me crazy in one of the 3-star tests, we have shoulder in to S and then S a half circle left and then a half pass. So shoulder in left sets you up nicely for the bend for the left half circle, but many riders straighten and then do the circle. And I almost want to scream in my box when they do that. But, you know, silly things that don't make sense make me crazy.
Think about the person who has written the test, who are all experts within the field. It's a panel of people who are massively experienced, and riders report back on it as well. And there's a huge amount that goes into it. They're not just sort of plucked out of the sky. I guess it's thinking, what are they asking from me at this point? Why is this movement leading into this movement? And actually, you know, as you go up the levels, it becomes harder and it becomes the intensity of which the movements come up. I know when we saw the Olympic test, 4 minutes or however long it was unbelievably intense at 5-star because it was literally bang, bang, bang. Question for you, what do you do if it all goes wrong? You're in your test, your horse has had a meltdown, or it's just not going to plan. What should you do at that point?
I would say keep looking ahead. Don't dwell on what's happened in the past. Forging ahead and hoping that the next movement might be a change in the horse's way of thinking and that we still have a chance of getting 6 movements or 5 movements or 3 movements of good quality. Don't dwell on the past. I see... Or don't dwell on the previous attempts to have good movements and they failed. I see so many riders just get all stewed up and it just adds to the fire and makes it just a complete mess right until the finish. Sports psychologists are so important in any sport, especially ours, to be able to deal with situations like this. And I think the great thing about what we do with those people whose specialty is preparation for sport is we talk about it and what we will do if it does happen. So if it has never been discussed and you're riding your horse and it completely has a meltdown, at least if you've had the discussion, you know, mentally you're going to be slightly better prepared to deal with it. But if you've never remotely even thought about it or discussed it with anybody, then if you are a hyper person, then, you know, this is when it's just going to go seriously downhill. This is where more relaxed personalities who have control of their emotions can salvage a test that's going bad and finish with some semblance of normalcy.
And I guess as well, it's the importance of, you know, you've already said, know your test, know what the judge is looking for at each particular movement. And if you know where one movement starts and finishes, then you might have chance to make some corrections within that movement. You've already lost some marks, but actually you can correct yourself before it bleeds into the next movement. Because ultimately, you could give a 1 and a 9 in 2 separate movements from the same test. And that's range of marks. That's absolutely okay, isn't it?
It's a wonderful thing to be able to give that range. Absolutely. Unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues who have been in the business for much longer than I have kind of get stuck on their small range of marks around 6 and 6.5. And I think one thing, I've had very, very good education, and I'm very proud of that and have been, that I had that opportunity. And yeah, using the range of marks, absolutely. I'm always ready to give a good mark if that movement is done successfully.
Range of marks. There we go, listeners. Okay, Peter, what are your top tips? If you could give our listeners 3 things to take away from this show that will help them excel in the dressage phase, what would they be?
My top 3, we've slightly touched on them. I think to really have a methodical warm-up, one that you've planned your time management and your schedule, and you've written it down to know exactly what you're doing, when. This will keep the rider, for me anyway, from staying calm emotionally. And then as you go around the competition arena, to have that tour, as we discussed before, to show the judge what you can do, not what you can't do. Second of all, in the actual test, to show the freedom of the gates, the quality of the gates, and the suppleness, the ability to bend. I have wondered why so many riders don't bend their horse on circles and in shoulder in moments where it's clear from the directives that you should be giving, showing bend. And I think either they think they're bending enough, but they're not. Or while I agree that the supporting dominant rein is your outside rein, but I think people are obsessed with the outside rein connection, and it is so strong that the bend simply can't happen. And thirdly, would be my most favorite saying, and which describes my judging the most and what every rider's goal should be: happy horse equals happy judge.
Love that. We could almost get a t-shirt with that made on, though, Peter. I think happy horse, happy judge. we're in there. No, honestly,
what a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll stick a hashtag on it as well. No, it makes a lot of sense. And everything that you've said, I think, is unbelievably useful. Listeners, I hope that you guys have found it useful. I hope that there might be a few riders that listen to this that are heading off to the World Championships in Pretoni later on in the year, because you never know, they might pick up some good, top, useful tips. Peter, thank you so much. It has been lovely to have you on the show. And we have battled all manner of technical issues, listeners. So this has been a hard-earned podcast to bring to you. And Peter has been so patient. So look, we hope you've enjoyed it. Peter, good luck this year. Enjoy at Kentucky, Aachen, and Pretoni, of course, and we'll look forward to seeing how it all pans out.
Thank you, Nicole. It was my pleasure, and great questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. Listeners, thank you as always, and we hope you've enjoyed a very special episode of the USEA official podcast. Coming up next time, we will be looking forward to Kentucky, and we have got some very special guests giving us their favorite Kentucky memories. You won't want to miss it. Stay tuned for that, but for now, that is all we've got time for. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the USEA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.